This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Your Money or Your Life, 9 Steps to Transforming Your Relationship with Money and Achieving Financial Independence by Vicki Robin and Joe Dominguez, with a foreword by Mr. Money Mustache. Read for you by Vicki Robin.
To Joe Dominguez, 1938 to 1997. Of course. Treasured mentor and companion on the great adventure, and to all he loved. Why read this book? Ask yourself these questions. Do you have enough money? Are you spending enough time with family and friends? Do you come home from your job full of life? Do you have time to participate in things you believe are worthwhile? If you were laid off from your job, would you see it as an opportunity? Are you satisfied with the contribution you have made to the world? Are you at peace with your money? Does your job reflect your values? Do you have enough savings to see you through 6 months of normal living expenses? Is your life whole? Do all the pieces, your job, your expenditures, your relationship, your values, fit together? If you answered no to even one of these questions, this audiobook is for you.
Foreword. There is really only one reason to listen to any audiobook about money: to give yourself the gift of a better life. Money is not really the thing you're after all. Would you lock yourself in a dark, silent box forever in exchange for becoming a billionaire? It seems obvious when put into such stark terms, but the truth about money is that money alone won't solve most of your problems. In fact, a healthy relationship with money is most often just a byproduct of living a happy, healthy life. Instead of a dark box billionaire, you are probably hoping to become a lighthearted, productive, free person who just happens to never have to worry about money again. This gigantic distinction is where most of the books, magazines, websites, TV shows, and podcasts ever created on the subject of money seem to fail. It's also the reason most people in the United States and other rich countries, despite our record income levels, remain just about broke, with many in record levels of debt. We're chasing more money and more of the things that it can buy, without questioning the big picture of exactly what we are buying and why. And this is the reason why this book, Your Money or Your Life, remains a standout classic after more than 25 years in print, with its message still echoing strongly enough through our society to keep new generations thinking about the ideas, and to bring Vicki Robin out of her peaceful island retirement to write this updated version. Robin's unique approach is what gives this book its unusual, unprecedented staying power. And this update takes the same approach and applies it to the significantly changed world in which we now live. The standard money advice is too meek, claiming that we all have different personal values and we need to follow our hearts. If I love $100 dinners out and you love expensive cars, that's fine. You can spend on those things you love as long as you budget carefully to afford it and work hard to make enough money for it. The reality is that most of this is nonsense. We're all humans, much more similar than we are different. Through centuries of philosophy and recent decades of more formal research, we've learned that there are a few genuine universal human happiness buttons that can be pressed, the same basic factors, such as friendship, health, community, overcoming challenges with your own ingenuity, and feeling in control of your life. These work for everyone. At the same time, most of us are tempted by the ideas of convenience, status, and luxury, and buying ourselves treats to satisfy these temptations. And we're really good at justifying some of these trinkets as our true passions. The only difference is in which things, and how many of them, we choose to justify. With just a few of the more expensive true passions, you can lock up almost any lifetime's income, sometimes eliminating your chance of claiming the bigger and more universal happiness prizes previously mentioned. Even the most well-known finance and business gurus repeat some version of this spending money equals happiness myth. Follow their advice, and you may just end up with a really well-polished conveyor belt of personal desire. Your skilled hands will be throwing goals onto one end of it and pulling satisfied bucket list items off the other, but you can still end up standing in the same place you started. Endless desire is one of the pitfalls of human nature, and one of the first things you need to cure if you want to get ahead more quickly. It is for this reason that your money or your life talks so much about so much more than money. It is a personal development guide to help you figure out what you really want out of your life, while also training away the money-wasting habits that you have probably developed that are getting in the way of it. And training really is a good way to think about it. You get better about this stuff slowly, by repeating small steps every day, which build naturally into bigger accomplishments. It all seems gradual, until you look back and barely even recognize your past self. How was I wasting that much of my time and energy every day without even realizing it? The result of all this training is not just an improved financial picture. It's an improved you. This is the reason the book remains so popular. There's a bigger picture here too, of course. The entire world and all the people and living things who share it. Far too often, we are taught that our spending decisions are simply a matter of our personal choices. If there's enough money in our wallets and room for the resulting debris in our garbage or recycling bins, we are clear for purchase. The reality is that almost everything we buy comes with a bit of unseen destruction somewhere else, and that damage has been adding up in recent decades. Facing the conflict between our lifestyles and the now constant news headlines about their consequences is a source of stress. The great news, as you are about to learn in this audiobook, is that streamlining your lifestyle for happiness will also dramatically cut down the amount of destruction that is done in your name. Make no mistake, it's almost impossible to read this book thoroughly without also drastically improving your financial situation for the rest of your life. The money part is definitely here, but the unique power of the method comes from working on the root of the problem, your personal beliefs and habits, rather than just the symptom of your monthly bank and credit card statements. If you've never listened to this book and taken this journey before, brace yourself, take your time, and take it seriously. Your entire life is about to be transformed. Mr. Money Mustache.
Introduction to the New Edition. Welcome. From millennials to Gen Xers to boomers, this makeover of Your Money, Your Life is for you. Since its initial publication, this book has become an enduring classic, helping hundreds of thousands of people to transform their relationship with money. The tools are evergreen, but the world has changed, and I've brought together the best team possible to make it relevant for today and many years to come. And for you. Of course you wonder, can it help you now? In your situation, can it help you get out of consumer debt? Revive delayed dreams? Get a place of your own? Leave a job that doesn't suit you anymore? Have enough money to afford some extras? Increase your income? Make the savings you have last longer? And even liberate you from working for money entirely? It can. Or better said, you can, if you use these tools. Because hundreds of thousands of people have indeed used these tools, I can make these promises. You'll spend less money and enjoy life more. You'll save more money than you ever thought possible. You'll flatten your debt and develop a natural resistance to spending more than you have for things you don't want to impress people you don't like, to paraphrase Robert Quillen. You'll have more time for what matters most. You'll learn a lot about yourself, relatively painlessly. You'll be at ease with talking about finances openly and honestly. You'll forgive yourself for the past money mistakes and get on with it. You'll save for retirement and get there, possibly a lot earlier than you can now imagine. You'll put your life in service to your values rather than putting your time in service to money. Financial independence. The purpose of the 9-step program in this book is to transform your relationship with money and help you achieve financial independence. The result is liberating your most precious resource, your time, to make room for more happiness, more freedom, and more meaning. What does it mean to transform your relationship with money? It doesn't mean getting more money or less money. It means knowing how much is enough money for you to have a life you love now and in the future. It means shifting from being a victim of money and the economy to making conscious choices. Anyone can do this. What do we mean by financial independence? At the most basic level, financial independence means no longer having to work for money. More than this, your money or your life takes you through a process of liberation that starts with freeing your mind from the illusion that buying stuff will make you happy or that more is always better. You see with such clarity the thoughts driving your money patterns that the patterns themselves evaporate. As you do the steps of the program, your debt melts away. With debt receding, you naturally build up savings. You no longer hit the panic button with unexpected expenses. Saving becomes a habit. You save more and more. Eventually, you can choose whether you work for love or money. This is how it's gone for many people and how it can go for you. As you read this book and work through the steps, you'll see that you need not be resigned to devoting the majority of your waking hours to making money. The 9-to-5 grind may be the societal default, but you can steer your life down different highways with off-ramps to your true calling and to a more pleasing future. What will you do when you no longer have to work for money? You may not know right now, but by doing the suggested steps, you'll have enough clarity, focus, and confidence that the dreams waiting for you to find them will start to appear. As one FIer, our term for a person who has applied the steps to achieve financial independence, says, this isn't really a book about money. It's a book about life. How this book came into being. Meet Joe Dominguez, the originator of this 9-step program. Latino by descent, raised on welfare cheese by a mother who never learned English, he grew up in Spanish Harlem in New York City. He was a runty guy and wicked smart. He couldn't use his brawn to survive, so he became the brains of his gang, learning to make explosives and plan strikes on rivals with successful getaways. His survival instinct was sharpened by necessity, and in part, your money or your life comes out of his canny ability to assess threats and opportunities and emerge from anything alive. As Joe saw it, the money system was like the welfare system and the justice system and the poverty system. How do I get through this on my own terms? In it, but not of it. He never graduated from college, but stumbled into a job in a Wall Street firm. Not satisfied to just learn the ropes, he analyzed the game, eventually developing some of the first tools of technical analysis in the early 1960s, when computers were the size of a city block. He did not invest his own money, but rather sold his expertise to one of the illustrious investment banking firms, and he saved with one goal in mind, retire by 30. Exit the money game. Be in life, not in the prison of a job. Joe and I teamed up in the 1970s in life and work. We were well matched in our purpose in life, to leave this world a little better than we found it. While our differences sometimes grated, they more often produced a flinty creativity that generated our nearly 2-decade teaching, writing, speaking, and, we hoped, world-changing. He was an introvert. I was an extrovert. He was systematic. I was improvisational. He was a big-picture thinker. I was more like a racehorse, taking the work by the bit and running with it, depending for strategy on his wider view. The culmination of our work, Your Money or Your Life, surprised us and everyone else by achieving instant success. By the time Joe died of cancer in the first weeks of 1997, we were at the top of our game. Your Money, Your Life had been a New York Times bestseller, as well as spending 5 years on the Business Week bestseller list. We believed that if enough people used these tools, Your Money, Your Life would be a lever long enough to change the world. After Joe's passing, I continued the work with a strong eye toward movement building, forming a common cause with the leaders of the flourishing simplicity movement and bringing our shared message to the halls of power and to global networks working on sustainability. By 2004, when I was diagnosed with my own spreading cancer, my racehorse was spent, and the lofty dream Joe and I had of transforming the way Americans think about, earn, spend, and save money had not really panned out, despite hundreds of thousands of grateful readers. I retired, moved to a village of 1,000 on an island in the Pacific Northwest, and turned my attention to making a difference here in this small patch of the planet. 12 years later, though, I heard the call again. I happened to be in a large circle of earnest people gathered to talk about money. Each, in turn, shared their confusions and fears. There was a well-off 80-year-old who didn't know if he'd run out of money before he ran out of years, and a mid-career professional in a rut but afraid to leave. Several consultants confessed their inability to help clients with money issues because they weren't any clearer. Lastly, a young college sophomore revealed that she was already $20,000 in debt. To get anywhere in her field, she assumed she'd need a master's and likely a PhD. She was worried about the gamble she was already taking, about whether her degree would be worth enough to ever repay her loans. The old fire in me started to rekindle. What kind of society requires everyone to depend for their survival on something so unstable, unreliable, and out of their control? What kind of society turns its young people into a profit center for the debt industry? I checked around the circle whether people were familiar with Your Money or Your Life. The yeses came mostly from those with gray hair. The noes from those under 35. Knowing how much Your Money or Your Life had liberated one generation, I thought perhaps it could help another one break the spell of the consumer culture and be free to give their considerable gifts in this decisive time. That's when I sought out young people to help me understand their circumstances and perspectives, and when I discovered how far the FIRE, financial independence, retire early, ideas had spread. With much encouragement from many friends, I undertook the careful work of updating a classic to be in tune with a new time. And so this makeover was born. For those who read the original version, rest assured that nothing of the bones of this program has changed, and all of the ideas you've come to love are still there. Changing times. There is no denying, however, that you live in a very different reality from the one in which Joe Dominguez and I, Vicki Robin, became financially independent. Boomers entered a stable world created by parents who'd survived the Great Depression and World War II. Government institutions, such as the progressive income tax and the GI Bill, fostered a growing middle class and a sense of social cohesion. For those navigating the workforce in the 21st century, the corporate landscape has changed. Pensions are in their death throes, and the thought of retirement is a pipe dream for the young and old alike. Nearly a fifth of all Americans over 65 depend solely on Social Security, with more than 50% getting half of their income from it. Young people fledge into a world where their bachelor's degrees don't guarantee income sufficient to ever pay off their debts, where everyone, no matter what their job, is in the yo-yo class. You're on your own. Today, more than at any time in history, the old rules have become fluid enough that you can move freely wherever you want, in location, in career, in your personal life, and in your purpose in life, no matter where you started. It's scary and exciting. People from all walks of life are navigating these rapids of change, some better than others. Adapting to a new world. How well is this new crop of humans in these times doing? I got curious, so I talked to every person in their 20s and early 30s I met, anywhere. I hosted a focus group. I perused Reddit and Facebook groups. I was surprised and impressed. The people I found had already incorporated the broken promises of the old American dream into their lives and were designing their lives not around a ladder of success, but around meaning, creativity, flexibility, and a sort of rapid prototyping, not just of jobs, but entire careers. Many are getting their education from a range of channels, technical training, skill development workshops, community colleges with name-brand universities as finishing schools, digital MOOCs, massive open online courses, apprenticeships, as well as traditional degrees. Gap years are more common. The growing percentage of people who don't have traditional jobs, work on their computers and set up shop in co-working spaces and maker spaces, in cafes and on unmade beds, never knowing whether they are on to the next big thing or just the next interesting step. They build networks, teams, startups, and proficiencies as they go, and they take breaks for travel or babies or self-reflection if they have a kit bag of skills that are portable and in demand. Not only that, Gen Xers and Boomers are learning from younger people how to navigate this changing landscape of work. Here are some stories about these innovative, adaptive young people. Brandon is the youngest of six children. His family had some means to help his elder brother attend college, but they were still short thousands of dollars every semester. To close the gap, his brother worked as a sales associate at a national grocery chain. By the time Brandon graduated from high school, his oldest sibling still worked at the same big box store for the same pay. College, the diploma, and the debt did not seem worth it. So Brandon went directly to working as a farmhand and then driving a tow truck. He's saving up to go to trade school to learn how to work in auto repair in an era of computerized systems, aiming to make $40 an hour. Chris got a degree in engineering, paid off his college debt in 1 year working at a major aerospace company, then saved up enough to take a year off to do a service project and travel. At the end of the year, he went back to work in a new and exciting role with a great pay package. Melody works in customer service at a rental car desk, saving up to get a nursing assistant degree at a 2-year college. From there, she'll see which new training she wants to take to move up or sideways in the medical field, and how long it will take at a new pay scale to pay off the cost of the certificate. Naomi did running start in high school, peeling a year off her college requirements, then did her second year at a community college before transferring to university to finish her degree in social work, all without accumulating crushing debt. Truly maximizing their potential, some students do 2 years of college and high school through the Running Start program. Older people already in the workforce are exercising this kind of fluidity and creativity as well. Doctors become carpenters. Carpenters become architects. Social workers become farmers. Art lovers leave office jobs and become tour directors for the great museums of Europe. Biologists leave the laboratory and lead people on naturalist trips to the remaining jungles of the world. Teachers become massage therapists. Soldiers apply their military training to a range of post-service professions, some highly technical and highly paid. Some find their passion and path early in life and become financial planners or real estate agents or doctors or professors for life. But more and more people, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, zigzag through a dozen jobs, moving up, moving sideways, moving down, but always moving. What about that more than 50% who get half their income from Social Security, who thought the good times would roll forever and failed to save and plan? They adapt through extending their working years, perhaps until they die. Others downsize or move closer to their children to reduce the burden of hiring help around the house. Many take advantage of social services, matinees, and free activities. They are involved in their communities, having fun by volunteering. And, taking a page from millennials, they have entered the gig economy as handymen, bloggers, or Airbnb hosts, turning their only asset, a house, into a source of income. Whether you're a senior in college, a mid-career worker, or soon-to-be retiree, the tools in this book can support you wherever you are in the spectrum of life and experience. Who is this book for? This program works for anyone who earns or spends money. Not because anyone can be rich, but because everyone can discover for themselves how much is enough and have that. It helps you transform your relationship with money, and we all have one. In fact, enough is the radical promise of your money or your life. Having more is an endless horizon. No matter how much you have, that voice of more would be better drives you to make acquisition the name of your game. Greed is one of the many strings in the human heart, and it can be pro-survival. But unchecked by a sense of fairness, balance, and love, it can gut our capacity for joy. Defining enough requires you to ask yourself some pertinent and crucial questions. What makes you happy? What is most important to you? What values will you never compromise? If you had $1 million right now, what would you do with your time? What's one thing you could get rid of to make yourself happier? A person doesn't count. Will you ever have enough money to retire? If someone today erased all your debts, would you dig yourself into that hole again? How or how not? Nobel laureate and best-selling author Daniel Kahneman, in his research on money and happiness, found that beyond a certain level of sufficiency, currently that's about $75,000 a year in the United States, more money doesn't buy more happiness. In our early seminars in the 1980s, we'd collect data from participants and analyze it on the spot to reflect the audience back to itself, using paper and pencil because it was long before laptop computers. Correlating participants' income with how much it would take to make them happy, almost everyone in every income bracket said 50% more than I have now. When asked to rate their happiness on a scale of 1 to 5, there was no significant difference between the top and bottom earners. You could hear a pin drop as people realized that the person in the row ahead of them probably had the more they thought would make them happy, and it made no difference. This data suggests that a conscious, clear, empowered relationship with money is the real key to success, not your quote-unquote number, that dollar amount picked out of thin air and set as a goal. When Your Money or Your Life came out in 1992, there were few books that spanned money and happiness in any practical way. Now there are hundreds of thousands of FIRE aficionados who, like the FIRES I've known, seem to share two powerful qualities. One, a purpose for their lives that's greater than their current limited circumstances, including their jobs. Two, a willingness to do the work of change, to tell the truth, to be accountable, and to persist. These qualities are like the kindling that lights the fire desire in people. As I've studied this fire movement, I've seen in its bones three strands, frugality, simplicity, and self-sufficiency, that have woven through people, societies, and religions for thousands of years. These values appeal to people of diverse financial means and across every political, cultural, and geographical spectrum. Christians have seen the teachings of Jesus in the pages of this book. Buddhists have seen Buddhism. Atheists have found the program's rationality trustworthy. While no two conscious money mavens are entirely alike, they do seem to follow certain trends. These aren't the only way to go, but it's useful to know what others out there are doing. I refer to the current crop as ninjas, minimalists, and do-it-yourselfers. Ninjas. Personal finance ninjas love to run the numbers, optimize systems, exploit niches, study personal finance blogs, mess with investments, hack the system to get free flights and hotels. Subcategories are the frugalistas, who love bargains, clipping coupons, free cycling, and deal making. And the super savers, who love beating last month's percentage of salary saved. Saving money is an all-American sport. Minimalists. It's not about the money, it's about the meaning. About clearing away the clutter to get to the marrow of life. These are the Thoreauvians, more likely to prioritize experience over things. They minimize stuff to maximize something non-material but more precious, the life of the mind, the soul, and so on. They could be called the soulfulists. Simplicity has been a perennial value of this land from before the colonialists arrived and since. Do-it-yourselfers. Money is not the point. Dinking around with the material world is where all the fun lies. Building, farming, tinkering, making, cooking, gardening, designing, creating, painting, or inventing. Unlike minimalists, having junk around is part of the creative process for do-it-yourselfers. These are conscious materialists, making the most of every scrap of life. A can-do attitude is as American as apple pie. You don't have to identify with any of these to want to transform your relationship with money enough to overcome your inertia and be drawn ever onward. But you have to want something more than the status quo. Common to all people who do succeed are accountability, self-awareness, and empowerment. They actually do the steps. Turtles and hares. How fast people move toward their own financial independence varies. I call it a spectrum from turtles to hares. The turtles use the program to slowly, steadily, methodically dig out of debt, moderate spending, and build savings with the assurance of arriving at some ripe middle age to be able to retire. They don't care how soon. They care that on the way, they've built a family and served their community and their boss with integrity, and visited all the national parks. The hares like speed, and often, like Joe, set an FI goal of age 30. Having a deadline is motivating, like a sprint to the finish line. They see that the more they save, the sooner they are free, and they often become fixated on increasing the percentage of each paycheck squirreled away. They beg forbearance from friends and spouses, promising them gobs of attention on the other side. Overall, whatever type you may or may not be, the key is to start and keep going. True, the starting line isn't the same for everybody. There's a gradient of privilege in the USA, and factors such as upbringing, race, and gender can make this much, much more difficult for some than others. Still, whether it's dreams of adventure and travel, of making a difference, of loving relationships and family, of self-knowledge and transcendence, the strength of your dreams and the grit of your commitment will move you forward. Through the thousands of communications from fans we've received, we know some of the way people's lives have been enriched by following this program. They finally understand the basics of money. At a tangible level, they settle their debts, increase their savings, and are able to live happily within their means. They reconnect with old dreams and find ways to realize them. With a great sense of freedom and relief, they learn how to distinguish between the essentials and excess in all areas of their lives and how to unburden themselves. On average, people at all income levels reduce their expenses by 25%, and most feel happier, even if, for the sake of their sanity, they forsake a bit of income. They find that their relationships with their partners and children improve. Their new financial integrity resolves many inner conflicts between their values and their lifestyles. Money ceases to be an issue in their lives, and they finally have the intellectual and emotional space to take on issues of greater importance. They increase their free time by reducing expenses and the amount of time on the job. They stop buying their way out of problems and instead use these challenges as opportunities to learn new skills. Overall, they heal the split between their money and their life, and life becomes one integrated whole. The four FIs. This program is designed to liberate your mind and your life from the thrall of the consumer culture. You don't use a different strategy, you think differently. We call this FI thinking, which is being ever conscious of and curious about the flow of money in your life. Just reading this book will initiate FI thinking in your life. But there's more. Actually, doing the simple steps outlined here will transform your relationship with money. You will master the four FIs, financial intelligence, FI1, financial integrity, FI2, financial independence, FI3, and financial interdependence, FI4. All of these will cascade naturally from applying these tools to the flow of money and stuff through your life. Financial intelligence. Financial intelligence is the ability to step back from your assumptions and your emotions about money and observe them objectively. Does money really buy happiness? Does everyone really gotta make a living? Is money really something to fear or covet, to love or hate? If I sell the majority of my time for money, will I really be secure? Gaining financial intelligence begins with knowing how much money you've already earned and what you have to show for it. How much is coming into your life and how much is going out. But that isn't enough. You also need to know what money really is and what you're trading for the money in your life. One tangible outcome of financial intelligence is getting out of debt and having at least 6 months of basic living expenses in the bank. If you follow the program presented in this book, it will lead inexorably to financial intelligence. Financial integrity. The dictionary defines integrity as 1. Firm adherence to a code of especially moral or artistic values. Incorruptibility. 2. An unimpaired condition, soundness. 3. The quality or state of being complete or undivided, completeness. Financial integrity is achieved by learning the true impact of your earning and spending, both on your immediate family and on the planet. It is knowing what is enough money and material goods to keep you at the peak of fulfillment, and what is just excess and clutter. It's having all aspects of your financial life in alignment with your values. If you follow this program presented in this book, it will lead inexorably to financial integrity. Financial independence. Financial independence encompasses a lot more than having a secure income. It is also independence from crippling financial beliefs, crippling debt, and a crippling inability to manage modern conveniences. Financial independence is anything that frees you from a dependence on money to handle your life. Financial interdependence. Along the way, you realize that the independence we crave is a separation from dead-end routines, jobs, and relationships, and a way of thinking, not from one another. Our happiest moments come from love and contribution, and we want more time for what makes life truly meaningful. Our interdependence, doing for one another, receiving from one another, creating with one another, is part of what makes our lives rich. Our interdependence is also a fact of life. We all depend on the services of the natural world. We all depend on shared institutions, from roads to airports to libraries, to a myriad of safety nets to money itself for a viable life. We float in a sea of interconnectedness. In fact, after achieving financial independence, most people, once they get enough rest and indulge some long-standing dreams, actually want to spend their life and their time helping to make the world a better place. What's new in this edition? I've made literally thousands of adjustments to the prior edition of this book to reflect today's reality, and two chapters in particular have been significantly revised. The advent of smartphones and the blogosphere and the myriad of internet tools for shopping and investing required a deep update of Chapter 6, The American Dream on a Shoestring. The heaviest lift, though, was to remake Chapter 9, Where to Stash Your Cash for Long-Term Financial Freedom. The investment strategy that served Joe and others very well for 25 years is no longer the only or best way to create a steady passive income stream. With input from wonderful colleagues across several investment philosophies, Chapter 9 now presents a range of strategies people in the FIRE movement use, resting on the same foundation of think for yourself. Readers of earlier versions will also notice a brand new tool, Money Talks. The 9-step program necessarily focuses on what individuals can do to free themselves from the work and spend treadmill. No one but you can take responsibility for transforming your relationship with money. For Joe and me and many of you, though, social support has been a big key to waking up and making changes. In the new epilogue, I present the simple Money Talks methodology, a proven way to talk with friends and strangers about big subjects, and money is one of the biggest. In each chapter, I offer a few potent questions you can raise in such conversations, whether in the privacy of your own journal, with a loved one, or in groups. When we talk with others about our dreams, confusions, fears, and persistent questions, change happens. Let the transformation begin. I hope that reading this introduction has whetted your appetite for learning about the 9-step program. Such an appetite for change will get you to take the first step. I hope your curiosity has been piqued. Curiosity will surely keep you moving. I hope your belief that you can change your future has gotten a boost. Next, listen to the whole audiobook from start to finish. After that, come back to Chapter 1 and begin your step-by-step journey toward transforming your relationship with money and achieving financial independence. Repeat listeners, welcome back, welcome home. And new listeners, welcome to a set of tools that has liberated hundreds of thousands of people, with my sincere hope that you will be one of them. The world needs you to show up and follow your dreams. Chapter 1, The Money Trap, The Old Roadmap for Money. Money, the tender trap? Your money or your life. If someone thrust a gun in your ribs and said those words, what would you do? Most of us would turn over our wallets, The threat works because we value our lives more than we value our money. Or do we? Rachel Z worked 70 hours a week as a successful saleswoman. But that wasn't it. She reported, after reading books like The Poverty of Affluence by Paul Wachtel, I realized that my feeling that something was missing wasn't something only I experienced. I began to talk with others and found that they often felt similarly let down. Having gotten the prize of a comfortable home with all the trimmings, there was a sense of, is this all? Do I have to work and work and then retire worn out to be put out to pasture? To do nothing then but to try to spend money I saved up and to waste my time till my life was over? Don M's love was music, but his life was working in data processing, and he'd all but given up the hope that love and life could go together. Unsure of what it meant to be a man, he'd assumed all the trappings of adulthood and waited for the day when they'd catapult him into manhood. He'd graduated from college and gotten a wife, a skill, a job, a car, a house, a mortgage, and a lawn to mow. Instead of feeling like a man, however, he felt increasingly trapped. Elaine H. just plain hated her job as a computer programmer. She did the bare minimum in order to keep her job, but did it so well that she couldn't be fired. She'd accumulated all the symbols of success, a sports car, a house in the country, but they barely balanced the boredom of her job. She went on to travel and participate in a variety of workshops, but none of these pleasures countered the doldrums of the work week. She finally decided that this must be how the rest of her life would be, with her job biting the center out of her life. Christy and her husband were classic dinks, double income, no kids, in high-paying tech jobs. They were young, rich, and good-looking. What could not be perfect about that? But then Christy watched her coworker collapse from stress and almost die at his desk. In Japan, they have a name for this, karoshi, death by overwork. When Christy saw this same person come back to work a week later, acting like nothing had happened, she knew that something was deeply wrong. Then her boss was hospitalized with a blood clot, and her best friend was fired. Christy started popping anxiety meds and bolting awake at 3 a.m. from stress. She thought, I can't do this anymore. This isn't worth it. Nicole followed her father's script. He was a lawyer and encouraged her to also get professional training, bugger the cost, because she would easily pay it off through her career. So Nicole got an advanced family nurse practitioner degree, which took more than 8 years and left her well over $100,000 in debt. But it wasn't 1969, the year her father graduated from law school. It was 2011, and her net earnings after paying staff, office rent, overhead, insurance, and continuing education was not enough to pay her debt faster than the interest built up. She was sliding backwards, even with a degree in one of the top in-demand professions. She admitted to a friend, I don't think I will ever pay it off. Brian's old friend Kevin stopped by on his way through town. In high school, Kevin had been that middle-of-the-pack guy nobody noticed. Now he was raking in six figures annually from an online educational product business. Brian grilled Kevin about every detail because he wanted to support his family and be a stay-at-home dad, teach people effectiveness tools, and, truth be told, have it all easy and quickly lucrative. He wanted what Kevin seemed to have. But while the online education business has a very low bar entry, anyone can piece together a few web services and voila, have paying students. Success is not a guarantee. So Brian spent money learning from the best and more money buying the best tools, and the business actually took many more hours than he anticipated to set up and run. The expensive goose has, to date, failed to lay any golden eggs. Even though some people really like their jobs, Very few of us can say with honesty that our work lives are perfect. The perfect work life would offer enough challenge to be interesting, enough ease to be enjoyable, enough camaraderie to be nourishing, enough solitude to be productive, enough hours at work to get the job done, enough leisure to feel refreshed, enough contribution to feel needed, enough silliness to have fun, and enough money to pay the bills, and then some. Even the best jobs have trade-offs. Midlife comes and we discover we've been living our parents' agenda, or worse, we've been filling teeth for 20 years because some 17-year-old, was that really me, decided that being a dentist would be the best of all possible worlds. We've joined the quote-unquote real world, the world of compromise. For all the hype about going for the gold, we're so weary at the end of the day that going for the sofa is as good as it gets. Most of us cling as long as possible to the notion that there is a way to live that makes more sense, that brings more fulfillment, that has more meaning. But over time, as our jobs wear a groove into our lives and our days fill with to-dos, the idea that we could have a more rewarding existence seems to fade. The people you'll be hearing about in this book have found that there is another way. There's a way to live an authentic, productive, meaningful life and have all the material comforts you want or need. There is a way to balance your inner and outer lives, to have your job self be on good terms with your family self and your deeper self. There is a way to go about the task of making a living so that you end up more alive. There's a way to approach life so that when asked, your money or your life, you say, I'll take both, thank you. We aren't making a living, we're making a dying. For many working people, however, from people who love their work to people who can barely tolerate their jobs, there seems to be no real choice between their money and their lives. What they do for money dominates their waking hours, and life is what can fit into the scant remaining time. Consider the average worker in almost any urban industrialized city. The alarm rings at 6:45, and our working man or woman is up and at it. Check the phone, shower, dress in the professional uniform, suits for some, coveralls for others, scrubs for the medical professionals, jeans and t-shirts for the construction workers. Breakfast, if there's time. Grab commuter mug and briefcase or lunchbox, hop in the car for the daily punishment called rush hour, or get on a bus or train packed crushingly tight. On the job from 9 to 5 or longer. Deal with the boss, deal with a coworker sent from the devil to rub you the wrong way, deal with suppliers, deal with clients or customers or patients, emails pile up, act busy, scroll through social media feeds, hide mistakes, smile when handed impossible deadlines, give a sigh of relief when the acts known as restructuring or downsizing or just plain getting laid off falls on other heads. Shoulder the added workload. Watch the clock. Argue with your conscience, but agree with the boss. Smile again. 5 o'clock. Back in the car or on the bus or train for the evening commute. Home. Act human with your partner, kids, or roommates. Cook. Post a picture of your dinner online. Eat. Watch an episode of your favorite show. Answer one last email. Bed. 8 hours of blessed oblivion, if you're lucky. And they call this making a living? Think about it. How many people have you ever seen who are more alive at the end of the workday than they were at the beginning? Do we come home from our quote-unquote making a living activity with more life? Do we bound through the door refreshed and energized, ready for a great evening with family and friends? Where is all the life we supposedly made at work? For many of us, isn't the truth of it closer to quote-unquote making a dying? Aren't we killing ourselves, our health, our relationships, our sense of joy and wonder for our jobs? We are sacrificing our lives for money, but it's happening so slowly that we barely notice. graying temples and thickening middles, along with dubious signs of progress like a corner office, a company car, or tenure, are the only landmarks of the passage of time. Eventually, we may have all the necessities, niceties, and even luxuries we could ever want, but inertia itself keeps us locked into the 9-to-5 pattern. After all, if we didn't work, what would we do with our time? The dreams we had of finding meaning and fulfillment through our jobs have faded into the reality of professional politics, burnout, boredom, and intense competition. That sense of wonder we had as children, that sense of mission we had in college, those times when love connected our hearts to all beings, great and small, are forgotten, all filed under, "We were so young." Even those of us who like our jobs and feel we're making a contribution have a sense that there is a larger arena we could enjoy, one that is beyond the world of 9-to-5. The fulfillment that would come from doing work we love with no limitations or restraints and no fear of getting fired and joining the ranks of the unemployed. How many times do we think or say, "I would do it this way if I could, but the board members of the Zilch Foundation want it done their way"? How much have we had to compromise our dreams in order to keep our funding or our jobs? We think we are our jobs. Even if we were financially able to turn our backs on jobs that limit our joy and insult our values, we're all too often psychologically unable to free ourselves. We take our identity and our self-worth from our jobs. Our jobs have replaced family, neighborhood, civic affairs, church, and even partners as our primary allegiance, our principal source of love and site of self-expression. Reflect on that for yourself. Think about how you feel when you respond to that getting to know you question. What do you do? With, "I am a blank." Do you feel pride? Do you feel shame? Do you want to say, "I'm only a blank"? If you aren't meeting your expectations for yourself, do you feel superior, inferior, defensive? Do you tell the truth? Do you give an exotic title to a mundane occupation to increase your status? Have we come to measure our worth as human beings by the size of our paychecks? When swapping tales at high school reunion, how do we secretly assess the success of our peers? Do we ask whether our classmates are fulfilled, living true to their values, or do we ask them where they work, what their positions are, where they live, what they drive, and where they are sending their kids to college? These are the recognized symbols of success. Along with racism and sexism, our society has a hidden hierarchy based on what you do for money. That's called jobism. And it pervades our interactions with one another on the job, in social settings, and even at home. Why else would we consider stay-at-home moms second-class citizens? Or consider teachers lower status than doctors, even though their desk-side manner with struggling students has equal merit to many doctors' bedside manner with the ill and dying? Whether we recognize it or not, our daily interactions involve the unconscious sizing up how each of us makes a living. The high cost of making a dying. Psychotherapist Douglas LeBeer documented this social disease in his book, Modern Madness. The steady stream of successful professionals who showed up in his office with exhausted bodies and empty souls alerted him to the mental and physical health hazards of our regard for materialism. LeBeer found that focusing on money or position or success at the expense of personal fulfillment and meaning had led 60% of his sample of several hundred to suffer from depression, anxiety, and other job-related disorders, including the ubiquitous stress. Even though the official work week has been pegged at 40 hours for nearly half a century, many professionals believe they must work overtime and weekends to keep up. A 2015 study from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, discovered that nearly 12% of Americans are working 50 or more hours per week. In addition, a conference board study of the same year found that less than half of Americans are satisfied with their jobs. We are working more but enjoying life less. The result, we have developed a national disease based on how we earn money. What do we have to show for it? Even if we aren't any happier, you'd think that we'd at least have the traditional symbols of success, money in the bank. Not so. Our savings rate has actually gone down. According to the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis,